sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
On today's show, you'll hear the speech given by Kevin Zeese at the Left Forum in New York City on June 4th, 2017. I co-organized several panels as part of a deep state track at the Left Forum both this year and last. Last year, all six of our panels were accepted, but this year, four out of our five were banned due to pressure from outside sources. The speech you'll hear today was part of the Left Co-optation panel, the only panel of the five to be accepted by the Left Forum. A 9/11 Truth colleague was so upset with the panels being banned that he rented two rooms in the same building as the Left Forum, and we had our panels anyway, and called it the Left Out Forum. You can see the videos for all five panels at the website noliesradio.org. In order to pull all of this off, we had tremendous support from our broader community who were outraged at our panels dealing with 9/11, false flags, the global war on terror, and thought crimes being banned. So Kevin Zeese is the co-director of Popular Resistance, a movement for social, economic, and environmental justice. He's been a political activist since graduating from George Washington University in 1980, and he is the co-host of the radio show Clearing the Fog. And here he is, Kevin Zeese. He starts out by saying that infiltration and co-optation are as American as apple pie.
I can remember at the beginning of Zuccotti Park, we immediately saw the ununiformed undercover police going in to do their infiltration work. And so right from the beginning, I'm sure in the planning stage as well. And of course, Zuccotti Park was not alone. We were involved in Occupy Washington, D.C. at Freedom Plaza. And we remember one of our first protests was a protest against a drone exhibit in the Air and Space Museum. It was going to be a very simple protest where you go in without big fuss, get in front of the drone exhibit, and die in front of the drone exhibit. That was the plan, very simple. But instead, we had two right-wing infiltrators who decided a different approach. And so as we got close to the Air and Space Museum, they created a rush to the Air and Space Museum to really scare our security a bit. And the security reacted, started tear gassing, spraying people in the face. And the next day, in one of the right-wing publications, American Spectator, the editor wrote about how he had been part of that infiltration. He was so proud of moving the protest into a more conflict-oriented, violence-seeming event to help to undermine Occupy right from the beginning. In Oakland, California, Cop Watch actually videotaped an undercover cop going into the encampment. They got a video of the police chief of Oakland talking about how they infiltrate, and that the infiltration is not just to spy and learn what the protest is up to, but also to direct it, misdirect it. And so he was very open about it, and they have videotape of us. If you want to learn more about what I'm talking about, I'm going to be very brief about this. We've run a couple of series of articles on infiltration, both during Occupy and traditionally in the United States. And I'm not talking about it all now, but there are a couple of articles on popularresistance.org. Just go to Google, popularresistance.org, infiltration, you'll find these articles that give you more details. But there were reports all over the country during Occupy of protester police infiltrators. And what they were doing was being basically monitoring us, learning the weaknesses in the group, and causing disruption and chaos. And we saw that General Assembly is a very common place for infiltration and disruption. And really, a General Assembly was like an invitation to infiltrators. Open to anybody. Come on in. We'll hear your views. And, you know, if the police, and what the police did was they monitored what was going on. They got to see what the characteristic of the assembly was, who the kind of players were. And so you're having this complete takeover, and they were very effective at it, and that turned out to be very problematic. We also found very common attacks were on media. Social media is another great invitation for infiltration and co-optation because anyone can participate, and they all have an equal voice. And so it's another new avenue, and Facebook in particular is an incredible tool for finding out about people and learning. By the way, if you go to Popular Resistance and Google Facebook CIA, you'll be amazed to see how much CIA money went into helping create Facebook. Under Bill Clinton, he allowed the CIA to create front group hedge funds that were used to fund projects, and Facebook got some of that funding. So you get kind of scared when you think about the information on Facebook and the role of the CIA in helping to create it. Another common thing was conflicts over money. That was a great area of creating conflict in the Occupy encampments, looking for payment. We need transparency. There were all sorts of personal needs. I need a Metro card to get to the meetings. That was a major focus at OWS, General Assemblies, late in the game, and we spent a lot of time debating those kinds of issues. And then there were also false occupies, like Van Jones's Rebuild the Dream, trying to mockupy and occupy. And really trying to pull us into the Democratic Party. And I was really pleased to see that there was resistance to that in many occupies across the country. They did not want to become the Tea Party and join, like they joined the Republican Party and become part of the Democratic Party. And there's good reasons for that, because the Tea Party and the Republicans basically agree on small government, no government regulation, low taxes on the wealthy, low taxes on businesses. They basically have the same agenda. And we don't have the same agenda as the Democratic Party. We're not a Wall Street war party. We oppose the domination of Wall Street. We oppose the imperialism of the United States and the never-ending wars of the United States. So it's very hard for us to go into the Democratic Party because we want a totally different political approach. And so it's not the same as the Tea Party. And so we resisted that, and that was good to see. But beyond Occupy, this kind of infiltration is U.S. history. It's hard to think of any political movement that has not been infiltrated. You have to expect it. It's part of the process. Women's rights, civil rights, racial equality, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Albert Einstein, Martin Luther King, they're all subject to this kind of surveillance and infiltration of their networks. This is just part of the way it works. And we just have to recognize that. And once we realize what they're trying to do, it becomes easier to defend against. And some of the learning of what they were trying to do came out of the Church Committee, which documented the history of FBI surveillance for purposes of political repression and misdirection and destruction of movement. So that was an area of learning. And they even said that this went back to World War I. This is not a new experience of a modern FBI, but an old experience of how political operatives work. And it's not just the federal government. It's the state and local police as well who play this kind of role. The Guardian published an article in 2011. This raises questions about Russiagate. Their article was 1 in 4 U.S. hackers are FBI informers. It's pretty interesting. So what does that mean for Russiagate? Is that an FBI scheme that's disguised as a Russian experiment? I'm amazed, by the way, at how Russiagate has become so accepted, even among people on the left. I guess it's this anti-Trump. We gotta get Trump on anything, so even if it's false and there's no proof, Russiagate works. One really notorious example of infiltration and misdirection was the 1968 Democratic Convention. There were about 10,000 protesters outside, anti-war, protesting the Humphrey and where they were going. About 10 years later, CBS News did a report based on federal government documents that found 1 out of 6 of the protesters were actually federal agents. That's 1,600 federal agents. And that's not counting the Chicago police, who have a very long history of this kind of activity as well. So that's pretty massive. Peter Camejo, who ran for governor of California in 2003, he ran for president as a socialist in 1976, and he was Ralph Nader's vice president in 2004 when I worked with their campaign. He always often told the story about how his presidential campaign was infiltrated and misdirected. They were having office break-ins, and they were able to get into court about those office break-ins, suing the FBI. And during their testimony, the agent in charge of the Camejo effort testified that they had 66 infiltrators working in the Camejo presidential campaign out of a total of 400 people who were working on the campaign around the country. And that went up to the campaign co-chair. So people who do this stuff know how to do it. My initial work in reform and change was on drug policy. I started working at Normal in 1980 and started a group called the Drug Policy Foundation, and was very involved in that issue. And in that, we started to get support from law enforcement people, or Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, LEAP. And a lot of those guys were undercover cops, former undercover cops. And talking to them about how they operate, made it really clear that it's very hard for us to, if someone's a professional infiltrator, it's very hard for anyone to know it. These people have tactics that are tried and tested. They know what they're doing. One of their most successful long-term tactics is to go into a movement and become invaluable, become like the campaign co-chair of Camejo, become a central player, and over a long period of time, develop relationships. And then from that position, they can be incredibly helpful to government. I remember some folks, some friends of mine who were going up to protest at the Republican convention in Philadelphia a few years ago. And on the way, they were pulled over by the police. The driver of the car turned out to be an informant, an infiltrator, and everyone else was arrested and detained, so they couldn't go to the convention. But that guy who was the driver had made himself invaluable. He would do what needed to be done to get things done. And so it's very tricky, just so you should realize that. The local police infiltrations have even a longer tradition than the federal. They go back into the 1880s. The Italian squad in New York City was a mafia squad. The Red Squad in Chicago was an anti-communist squad. A 1963 report estimated 390,000 officers were involved in surveillance of political activity. 390,000 officers in 1963 involved in surveillance activities of political organizations. Chris Hedges tells me, when he's covered revolutions around the world, that what you see on the outside as far as open police efforts, expect to have the same number involved in undercover police efforts. And the activities have gone up to including assassination. Yeah. Political leaders. You know, some very famous cases. Freddie Hampton in Chicago, the Black Panthers, is one that stands out. And there was an infiltrator who got the police into that. People he relied on for protection was actually a police infiltrator. And it goes back to the Bonus March, which was an amazing march. Another Occupy in Washington, D.C. in the 1930s, where World War I vets and their families, 20,000 plus 20,000 supporters, were occupying Washington. Police and military were totally ingrained into that as well, so they knew what was going on. And one of the more aggressive efforts of Resurrection City, which was Park Service, monitors around the encampment, audio and videotaping. So they were totally on top of what the Resurrection City was up to. And what were the goals? According to a report on COINTELPRO, which COINTELPRO was the FBI program that was supposedly stopped in 1976. I think it continues under different names now. But goals, they said, were to create a negative public image for protest groups, surveil activists, and then release, you know, personal information to the public to undermine them, and sometimes, of course, even false personal information. They want to break down the internal organization, create conflicts by having agents exacerbate racial tensions or sending anonymous letters from one member of the organization out and then showing that anonymous letter, you know, to other colleagues that create the fake letter that create conflicts. Chaos is their goal, to divide and control. They restrict access to public resources by pressuring members of the nonprofit industrial complex to not provide support, to stay away, criticize, show that kind of division between the nonprofit community and the radicals who are taking action. The also goal is to restrict the ability to organize through agents promoting violence, property destruction, challenging the police, attacking the police. We saw that in Occupy as well. We had people who definitely tried to line up less experienced activists when we were being threatened with eviction, getting less experienced activists prepared to stand up to the police and have a conflict with them when they came, which of course wasn't our strategy. We had a kind of more sophisticated approach and ended up staying on Freedom Plaza for something like 4 months. And they restricted the abilities to work in group activities with character assassination. They'd even do false arrests to make someone look bad, and we saw that with Occupy as well. What was interesting with Occupy, with the FBI approach, was they didn't go after leaders that much, except in character assassination. When it came to actual arrests, they went after people who were kind of fringe, people who had some alcoholism or other troubled issues that they could get to and manipulate, and when they arrested those kind of people, trapping them into a plot to blow up a bridge or some nonsense that they had no capacity to do, it would be a strike on the whole movement. You know, look, they're terrorists. They're planning on blowing up a bridge. But they would pick people who they knew they could manipulate with drugs, alcohol, sex, whatever was necessary. And so it's pretty interesting to see how that tactic changed from going after leaders to going after the fringe that they could use to embarrass the movement. So lots of techniques used. And as I said, Facebook is one to look at as a new, they have so many more tools now than they did in the COINTELPRO area, with NSA surveillance, with social media, with Facebook. I mean, so much information on Facebook, it's incredible. They almost don't need to actually infiltrate to find most things out. Of course, sometimes we do use the security culture, we'll talk about in a second, to try to minimize the key issues not being known by the police. So what is the goal? A really interesting, I think, window into the goals of these infiltrators to how they co-opt us and control us is some leaked documents from Stratfor. Stratfor is a corporate intelligence agency. And the document, essentially, they're develops a strategy of divide and rule in a very sophisticated way. Divide and conquer. They divide movements into four groups. They're the radicals, they're the idealists, the realists, and the opportunists. The radicals, idealists, the realists, and the opportunists. And a goal of their strategy is to isolate the radicals, make them the fringe, not allow them to pull the other categories to them. They can divide us from the rest, and each group that they can divide, it makes it stronger. They can get the three other groups away from the radicals, they can really ensure a movement accomplishes nothing. That comes from Stratford documents. And if you go again to popular resistance, just Google popular resistance, how corporations control movements, you'll find an article, a couple of articles that go into detail about this. This is much more than I'm going to be able to do today. But opportunities are obviously the easy group. They are looking for a chance to be inside and meet with members of Congress, or be inside and meet with the president, or get a job at CNN like Van Jones has, or you get paid, make money off this. And opportunities are easy. Realists are also relatively easy. Politics is the art of compromise. Don't seek what you really need. Seek what you can get. In fact, I saw Obama was quoted about his experience as a so-called community organizer. That was his strategy as a community organizer, was not to seek what he wanted, but to seek what he could get. And I think that's the realist approach that really is easy to deal with. The idealists are kind of a swing one. They can be pulled into those other two categories if the momentum goes that way. And I think a really great example of co-option of a movement was the fight over Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. The nonprofit industrial complex in Washington really supported single payer. They've been saying it, their constituents wanted it. That's what they really wanted. But what happened was, through massive contributions, they were able to pull that whole nonprofit community to support the ACA. Sometimes they'd use the public option as a way to, look, you can get the worm that you can go for, which was an inadequate worm to begin with. It wouldn't have worked. We know from previous experience about public options, it actually does not work. It actually helps the insurance industry because it relieves them of people who need health care. Mm-hmm. They just get to get the people who have money and don't need health care. That's what they want. That's how insurance works. But this was a great example because the true single-payer community stayed strong in advocating, but they had no resources. While these dozens of members of the nonprofit industrial complex got tens of millions of dollars, literally tens of millions of dollars, to split between them to fight for the Obamacare law. And it was also beyond that, they were heavily controlled. They would meet once a week with the White House, near the White House, at a hotel. Jim Messina, who at that time was a member of the leadership inside the White House, working with Rahm Emanuel and those kinds of folks, later on became the campaign manager for Obama in his second run, is one of the people helping Theresa May right now in the UK in her run against Corbyn. Jim Messina would hold these meetings and tell the nonprofits what they could do and what they couldn't do, what the target was this week, what they couldn't say. And when it got to really intense times, they would bring funders to those meetings as well. Not a very subtle message, but a pretty strong message to make sure they stayed in line and did their job. And so I think that's a really key example, and they couldn't have done it without dividing us. If the single-payer movement had stayed united, and the people who had always supported single-payer stayed with that issue, and the nonprofit community stayed with the radicals, we would have had a very strong movement of movements to push for a real solution. And I think we could have gotten it. It's amazing how far we got without that kind of unity, and how far we were able to get a single-payer bill onto the floor of the Senate, Bernie Sanders' bill. That'd be a substitute amendment, replace Obamacare with single payer. Harry Reid skipped over it. This was right near Christmas. They were ready to take winter break. And they were already behind schedule, so they really were upset that Sanders did this. And so Reid skipped over it. There were numerous in order, And so we did a protest that day, the next day, where we had cutout bodies, dead body kind of police cutouts, with the numbers of people dying because of lack of health and access in each state. And we went from room to room, and some senators got pretty upset with us. You upset my staff with that. But we got to Harry Reid's office, and by then we had a photographer, professional photographer from Getty, and CNN following us. And so we put the dead body out on Reed's floor, and the photographers were there taking pictures, and they sent out their deputy chief of staff, and he met with us. And after that weekend, the next day, after the weekend, Sanders and them was on the floor. And it was it played out interestingly. I mean, it was a 400-page amendment, and one of the Republicans demanded that it be read in its entirety. And so they started reading it. Sanders had a staffer reading it for him, and then Reed made some deals with Sanders for money for community health centers and the ability to opt out of Obamacare in 2017, and also time for him to give a half-hour speech about single-payer. And so he agreed to accept all that and pull the amendment. But then there were people doing whole readings of it in Central Park who made an issue of that. But this is a key thing, this division. The reason why we won the TPP was because they didn't succeed in dividing us. We had labor, environmental, food, anti-corporate, all sorts of, it was a movement of movements that stayed united to fight the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And that's how we won. That's how we won the first round of net neutrality. Same thing. We had the radicals and the reformers all together fighting for net neutrality. We're trying to duplicate that now with this current fight, which is a much tougher fight. But being united like that and not letting their divide and conquer strategy rule really is one of the most important steps we could take. Then we've seen the opposite. Sierra Club, for example, was taking money from the gas industry during the time when fracked gas was just getting to be an issue. And they had this campaign, you know, called the Clean Sky Initiative, which favored gas as a step toward clean energy. Totally, it turned out to be, I don't know if they knew it in time, but I think they must have known it, because it seems pretty obvious, that gas is not a clean energy. Methane is actually more of a climate-destroying gas than carbon is, and there's always leaks in these methane drilling operations and in these fracked gas pipelines. They stopped taking the money, by the way. They got a lot of public outcry for that. But at the time, it really helped to let fracked gas become an industry. And that was another great opportunist opportunity for Sierra Club. They got a lot of money, and that divided the movement on fracking. It's since united and has become a pretty good, strong movement. We've got a band in Maryland. You had a good fight with Cuomo here in New York. And so there is now a pretty strong movement. So, and one way they isolate the radicals, by the way, is also with false arrests or arrests on minor charges. Like, I think Julian Assange is a great example of that. Those charges now have been, the investigation has been stopped. They interviewed Assange initially, the prosecutors decided not to pursue it. Then a political prosecutor took it over, restarted the investigation, and you know the rest of the story. And finally, just recently, they decided not to pursue it any further. But that was a great way to isolate Assange from the media, from lots of progressive thinkers, and that's a very effective tactic. So how do you deal with infiltration? Let me just quickly deal with that. There's no easy answer. But now when you know what they're trying to do, like taking over social media, one of the things we did a survey of Occupy encampments, and one of the most common things was taking over social media, taking over the Facebook page, taking over the website, the email list. And in Arizona, they deleted all these videos of police abuse and police arrest that were going to be used in people's defense. They got disappeared. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania, they put out emails saying the opposite of what people want to do. We're talking about they talk about when the police come, we'll go willingly, we'll obey. And others wanted to actually stay and risk arrest and make an issue of their being evicted. But the infiltrators got control of the news sources from the Occupy and misled people, so it caused complete confusion. So that's one area where you really got to be careful. Who gets access to your Facebook page? Who gets access to your Twitter account? Who controls your website? That has got to be something that's a high priority to be aware of, because it's a very powerful tool and one that can be easily taken over. Once it's taken over, they can actually can kick the other people out. The administrative privileges, they can say no to the people who were actually running the social media. And so that's a very powerful tool. But I think it's very important, even though we know infiltration is going to happen, not to get paranoid. And there are a number of different things you can do about how to deal with it. And one of them is to be somewhat transparent. Most of the stuff that we do, even though it's illegal and violates various trespass rules or other minor laws, is not a big threat, and we can pull it off if the police know about it. One of the first times I was arrested was in the medical marijuana protest during the Ashcroft era, and we had planned to chain ourselves in the Department of Justice doors protesting Ashcroft's attack on medical marijuana, even though states are legalizing it. And so we all had pictures of a patient on our chest, and we had lock boxes that we were going to lock ourselves in the doors and all these plans. And after it was over, one of the cops started getting friendly, and he was telling me how they actually knew about what we were up to. And we even knew when you guys had car troubles that morning that you were going to be late. And we were actually out in the park practicing, jumping out of the back of this car with the lock boxes and chaining ourselves. And so we were at the park just practicing there. And we saw a van with an antenna on it about a half a block away. And then when we got up and left, we actually saw the van make a U-turn and follow us. So they were on us. But the interesting thing is they let us do it. So even if they infiltrate, it doesn't mean they're going to stop you. The infiltrator, we figured out, there's an African-American college-age woman who came to our last planning meeting with a hat covering her face a little bit. And, of course, all these white progressives, oh, wow, black woman, man, 2 for 1, holy cow, this is great. We're finally getting diverse. But it turned out she was actually an infiltrator, and she relayed the information. They did follow us, but I said, they let us do it. So first off, don't get paranoid. What we're doing, they don't want to expose themselves for some things, and it's often better to let us have our protest, make our point, get our pictures, arrest us, and then we all go home after we go to jail. And the other thing about infiltration is very hard to tell. I told you about the undercover narcs, who, how professional they were, and how co-chair of the Mayo campaign. These people are pretty good at this. So it's often very hard to tell. And it's very hard to tell sometimes who's just a troubled personality versus an infiltrator. So don't make accusations. Making accusations just creates paranoia and conflict. You're adding to their ability to undermine us. And don't make accusations, but work around it as best you can, unless you have real proof. Now, if you have real proof, good to expose it. We've seen that work before, too, where you have pictures of an undercover cop who ends up throwing a punch at a police officer or throwing something at a police car, and then you later on see him meeting with the police, and you can see in the picture he has the same police boots on when he's infiltrating and the same police boots on when he's with the police, and he's the same guy. And so exposing that, you can really prove it. But if you can't prove it, don't go there. It's more counterproductive than productive. And we have to recognize that bad behavior is not always infiltration. There's a diversity of tactics, and people have different views on what's effective and what's not effective. And I think that's the way I like to frame the debate, not violence versus nonviolence, or property damage versus non-property damage. What's working? What can work? If you frame the debate that way, I think you have a much better discussion among your group about where you're going. If you know what your strategy is, your goals and tactics, then it makes sense. But I think a discussion about why you want to do violence or why you want to do property damage, if someone brings that approach up, whether they're infiltrators or not, is it effective? That's the question. The security culture. Something to be very careful of, but if you're going to do it, be open about it. Let everyone in the project know that you're going to use security culture for part of this planning, and so people shouldn't be offended by that's being done, and explain the reasons why, that you're not going to tell everybody everything. There are some parts of the event we'll be public about a lot, but there's some parts of the event that we can't be public about because then they can stop us. I remember we did a camp in Washington to stop the TPP camp. It was a training and a planning encampment, and we had planned to take over the U.S. Trade Representative building, which is right across the street from the White House, and every half block there's a little police substation. And so it's a very heavily policed area. And so we had a plan to take over the building, drop massive banners to expose their secret trade agreement by putting it all over their building and saying, this is where the trade agreement is being negotiated. We were going to do it at midday, lunch hour. And we decided to pick the place because at the time the USTR building was being fixed and they had scaffolding along the side. And so we were all prepared. There were workers. We were prepared to deal with the workers. We did a last scout the morning of, and the workers were off that day, which was like, wow, what a blessing. This is like an invitation. And during the encampment training and planning process, there were people who came in who were suspicious. And if we don't know people who come into our camps, we talk to them. We want to see why they're there, what's motivating them, what they want to accomplish. And sometimes if you get in that kind of discussion, it becomes pretty evident. And so even though you don't make an accusation, like one person came in and Margaret Flowers, who's a doctor and a single-payer activist, interviewed him and she says, what is it that you care about? Oh, I really care about healthcare. Healthcare, I think, is a really big concern that we should all join single-payer,
Really.
And so she said, that's an interesting TPP response. And so we decided to have him paint the train that we were going to be using as part of one of the tools that we would have for our takeover. And so he spent the day painting for a while and he left relatively quickly. But he didn't go into the room with the people who were actually doing the takeover of the building. So everyone was very freely involved, keeping busy, doing lots of stuff, but a small group of about 10, 12 people who were actually involved in that part of what was going on, that was a group we knew everybody in. That was a group that we had total confidence in who was part of it. And even people who were staying the night, working all weekend, didn't necessarily know what was going on. So I think security culture is a tool, and I think one that we should use, but again, cautiously, because we don't want to create paranoia. And the nothing to hide approach should be the first tactic, I think. We have nothing to hide. What we're doing is right. We're on the right side of this issue. We're going to do the right thing. And then no one's going to get hurt. No property damage, not a big problem. So let's just be open about it. Invite people to it. And so when you know their tactics, it really helps. You know they want to divide us. We know they want to take over our social media. We know they want to put out false stories. If you start to know that stuff, it makes it easier. Now, sometimes it comes to a point where movement gets so polluted by infiltrators who create division and chaos among the group that you have to just leave and start over. I mean, we are not there for an organization. We're not there for a particular protest. This is a long-term effort of change. And so it's okay to say, that's just not working anymore. Let's leave and start something new. And so we've had to do that a lot of times. That's something that's happened, again, we know people involved in other movements in other decades who have gone through that and walked away as well. At a certain point, you just got to face it and start fresh.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.